to Artery with Isa Caveggia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist specializing in a particular cultural context has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and responsibility in art. In this episode, an anonymous anthropologist speaks with artist Nazlie Tabatabatai Katambash. In a twist on the usual practice of keeping the interlocutor's identities anonymous, the anthropologist decided to obscure their own instead. I will now hand over to the anonymous anthropologist, who will introduce their guest.
Hello everyone, welcome to this episode. I'm your host, an anonymous anthropologist. And today with me is artist Nazlie. Nazlie Tabatabatai Katambash is an artist across disciplines, a leadership consultant, and soon to be PhD in opera at Guildhall School of Music and Drama from September 2021. Thank you so much for joining us, Nazlie.
It's an absolute pleasure to join you, anonymous anthropologist.
Yes, so we have a question which related to COVID. So artistic speaking, do you have any thoughts on COVID? All of us are still in now, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some really interesting parallels with practices that from many countries in different contexts where working socially distanced was actually a practice that was quite, inverted commas, normal for them. So for us here in the UK, more specifically, where I've been practicing now to be in contexts where almost a full production, and indeed full productions, happen entirely online. But then more specifically to my recent experiences of working within an opera context at Guildhall, observing 3 meters apart from an opera singer changes dynamics, and indeed being 2 meters apart or 3 meters apart from an instrumentalist. So you can begin to imagine how the distances we keep as people has found its way onto our stages and into our creative spaces. But distance, physical distance, doesn't necessarily equate to loss of intimacy.
That's very interesting. You just recently defended your viva on this opera piece, Paradise Garden. How did you start this piece?
So the piece Paradise Garden is a collaboration between myself and the composer Emily Hazratti. And the start point of it came about from initially we were asked to pitch 3 ideas to our supervisor and to the teaching team, to and also the director that was going to be involved. And I was super excited about Paradise Garden from the beginning, but we were trying to stay excited equally for the other two because they may have been chosen. But in that process, having an awareness for us was about concerns around the World Economic Forum. So from a global perspective, that the three factors that we're learning from the forum are about forced migration, climate crisis, and of course, ideas that relate to biodiversity. So I was very keen, and so was Emily, to in creating a new contemporary opera that we, as much as we could, to consider, always consider a global narrative. So Paradise Garden, I hope, held elements of those concerns that interested myself and Emily. And that one of the other intentions we had was that the piece would be a piece for optimism.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what do you mean a piece of optimism?
I think that our intentions around that was that we didn't portray an opera that had a didactic solution to the narrative that it offered, that it offered a space where people could witness people dancing, could witness people laughing, could witness enjoyment and joy, more specifically joy than necessarily an idea of happiness. And that we felt that sometimes for us, when we experience artworks that connect with a sense of joy, we would be more open to what came next.
And while you were driven by this pursuit of optimism, joy, as well as global narratives, were you also attracted by particular feelings, experiences, or observations,
which
comes into the piece as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That I was very interested, and so was Emily, in this idea of love and duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that quite often in opera, love conquers all. Actually, that's not necessarily restricted to the discipline of opera. But for us, we wanted to make a space to celebrate duty, a love that can come from duty, of making choices that are more about self-determination than necessarily a single person's self-expression. It was ideas that we were hoping to, through the opera, to communicate that actually sometimes in life, the love between friends, the love of duty, the love for compassion is an equal love to romantic love. And within Paradise Garden, romantic love does exist, but it isn't the centrality that we decided to focus on.
I think that this comes through quite well in the piece itself. But I think our audience perhaps not really familiar with this piece. Do you mind briefly introduce the piece?
No, my pleasure, absolutely. Paradise Garden is set in the year 1600 in the Gregorian calendar, and it takes place within a secret garden that belongs to Maria de' Medici. Maria de' Medici was a historical figure that lived. So this is an imagined meeting between Maria de' Medici, who went on to become queen consort of France to King Henry, and the recently crowned Shah Abbas of Iran, the king of Iran. And within it, there is another character called Venus, and how Venus connects to the concerns of Shah Abbas within the piece, because he enters the secret garden in disguise because Maria is in seek of an aphrodisiac, but he himself is in seek of a cure, because as some of us may be familiar, in 1600, there was a cure that ravaged across Europe. And it was certainly something that generations to come, and even as we live now, the idea of plague, of pandemic, isn't far from our current lived experience.
Yes.
But I don't want to say too much more about it. In case people want to see it for themselves.
Yes, I think that's a good idea. I think there's a lot of interesting elements going on in the opera itself. Something for people who might more familiar with your work is kind of connect to your previous work as well, and some motif and like such as birds.
Absolutely, yes.
So how do you see this kind of slow kind of evolution of your artistic kind of repertoire across different pieces? How does it come on and off in different places of your work?
I'm really humbled that you choose the motif of birds, because it's something that has walked in my practice for a long time. So for example, when I go to a new city or a new place or a province, the first thing that I tend to do is to record the sound of the birds. And the sound of birds for me, symbolically, I think for me personally, is how the sound of birds can carry the voices of the people. And that for me is a really powerful idea, because birdsong is influenced by the human voice, and human voice in the absence of birdsong for me is quite a lonely thing. So particularly in Paradise Garden, Shah Abbas, while he's still disguised as the merchant Rostam, tells Maria that the Shah listens to the birds. He wants to hear the voices of the people, which connects with, of course, the poetry of Atch, the long poem, The Conference of the Birds, which the conceit within that is, and forgive me for spelling it out for everybody else who knows probably more about this piece than I do, this epic poem more than I do, but in the context of our conversation, the sense of self-determination is something that I find particularly compelling.
Yes, and when you mention about the voice of people, people don't refer to everyone, right? People is a concept.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I hope that in Paradise Garden, it begins to nod to exactly that, that when we say people, we are referring to groups we know. We are referring generally to, even when we are referring to, inverted commas, the other, it is a perceived notion of a group of other. Very rarely do I witness the term people to truly mean every human being across and within the planet, having lived before or yet to come. I think that's an excellent observation. But Paradise Garden, I hope, begins to open up very quietly a line of thought around people. What do we mean when we say people?
Yes, and also I witness you coming from the background, initially from film, and then you translate yourself into theater. And after many years of successful theater career, now you was venturing into this new water, which is opera. So is there anything new or which inspire you to pursue various kind of disciplines?
I think that for me, the pursuit of various disciplines is, as an artist, and I say that super humbly, as an artist, it's the renewal, reinvention. I'm interested in different canvases with the many meaning of that word. I think that different disciplines offer different modalities of storytelling. They are also different access points to different types and kinds of publics and different kinds and types of audiences. I think that I must have always been traveling towards opera because, yeah, absolutely, my background in visual art, in the medium of using digital film, photography, my love of theater, music, and opera. Opera needs all of those things in order to be the discipline that it is. It is the singular discipline that invites every other art form within it in order for it to stand and be what it is. So I think I was always heading in the direction of opera. I may not have known it.
Yes, but also opera is very curious form because mm-hmm. it sometimes can have some distance according to, you know, people's audience class background mm-hmm. or their cultural capital as we know it. Mm-hmm. And so how do you say this kind of charm of opera as well as this distance opera created among us?
You're absolutely right. The sense of the paradox, because quite often opera is interpreted as an elite art form. Opera is interpreted as a distancing art form. It is an art form sometimes described as a perpetrator of harm. It is considered perhaps a distancing object, a very divisive discipline. These things we can evidence, of course, but to take that evidence further, to examine further, I would suggest that many of those are constructs of power. Many of those are constructs of economy. I think the discipline itself does not inflict harm. I think that opera is an extraordinary mode of expression. And whether you meet it with the music or the visuals or the singer or the body or the the different sensorial experiences. But to come back to your point as of opera as being divisive, I think there are certainly systems within that. And I think this is why I, in many ways, am so attracted to contemporary opera, because for me, opera needs to be on the street. Opera, there's no reason why it can't be. There's no reason why our opera houses cannot be reimagined. I don't think that any art form ought to be dismantled, because that in itself is a form of censorship. Do I think that there are some pieces that need to be retired to a museum? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Of course. Yes, I do. Do I think that there are some processes and systems and practices that need to be retired to a museum? Yes, I do. And then we are able to make more space for what can be and is. Opera has thrived during COVID. Access to opera has been unprecedented. People being able to train, people being able to see the work, people being having well-being experiences because of opera. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. I think opera was one of the first art forms to go online at great speed.
You mainly mean as a digital streaming.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. for it to be, and for the monetary barrier to be removed. And I don't think necessarily monetary barriers is the only barrier. But I think at times we need to find out if it is.
Mm. So it's also natural, reminds us about when you're talking about art and duty, and where we are talking about this kind of division within art form. So people not necessarily link art with duty or responsibility in their mind. But I think it's a recurring theme for you as a human being. You want to be ethical and you want to be responsible. But can you elaborate a little bit of your vision of the relationship between you being artist and you also being someone who is very drawn to this idea of responsibility?
I'm very drawn to ethical practice. I'm very drawn to equitable ways of working. I'm very drawn to finding frameworks that can enable us to really engage with ideas of equality, diversity, inclusion, access, all in the name of being far more fluent and compassionate collaborators in order to make art that is even better than we've ever imagined. So I'll give you an example, a very early part of the process with my collaborator, with Emily, was to, and this was in the context of our broader experience at Guildhall, was to have a collaborative agreement between us. And this was about what we needed as individuals, but also what we needed as collaborators within a bigger system of collaboration. Opera is a highly collaborative discipline. Yes, it is hierarchical, but there is a paradox. There is a paradox. But to give you perhaps a more direct example, I can't ever separate the idea that the rise of opera came about in a rise of an economic context of the enslavement trade, the transatlantic enslavement trade of 1600. Countries that became leaders in opera were also instrumental in the development of the transatlantic slave trade, enslavement trade. So within Paradise Garden, there is a thread of narrative of enslavement and of an individual through claiming their duty and purpose, then going on and having and being making the case for their freedom and being given it. I'm interested in how do we negotiate identities that we are given. I am interested in, as people, how do we shift from one state of being to another. I'm interested in how do we evolve our thinking. But again, for me personally, I do this through storytelling, through the art form. I don't want to replicate a moral position we already have. I'm interested in expanding the vocabulary on a given moral position so that people who are making the work with me and are engaged in the creation process and the audience and in contexts such as this, that it is a generative tool. It is something that sparks further conversation.
Yeah, I think I have two questions, which link to what you just said. Mm. One is you're talking about the slave trade, which is in the same time period when the opera mm-hmm. becomes an art form. I was interested in your piece, Paradise Garden, you mm. have the person who's enslaved, but it's also actually someone who should be worshipped. You know, like it's from someone who is at the lowest mm-hmm. in this hierarchy, but yes. also lived into this highest hierarchy.
Yes.
And I think that this is very interesting transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And also when you're talking about this, when this person who's enslaved, the figure who's enslaved in that piece is actually saying she loved the person mm-hmm. who enslaved her, mm-hmm.
yeah.
and they were at the same and one.
Yes.
And I think this kind of paradoxical dynamics mm-hmm. between this somehow triangle relationship mm-hmm. is very interesting. Do you want to say more about this?
Yeah, I very much appreciate the observation that you make that this character, Venus, begins low status and is suppressing an identity and has an identity, and her identity has been forced upon her as a suppression as well. So there's those two dualities happening. And then there is this between her and the person who bought her, inverted commas, traded for her. Love happens between them. And status shifts again because Maria de' Medici names her Venus. And I should point out again, this was not historical. It didn't happen. This is totally imagined. Totally imagined. Totally imagined. But this idea that through seeing how Maria is taking on her responsibility, her duties, because although Maria is of higher status, at the end of the day, even Maria de' Medici has to perform a sexual act with the King of France. There's still a trade-off here. They are not yet living the feminism they want to live. So this idea that seeing how Venus then truly becomes herself or reclaims herself, and this idea that Shah Abbas calls her Ishtar because she shares the name with the goddess of war and love and is a healer, and he has been seeking this healer, but she is very quick to draw this clarification that she's not a god, she is a skilled woman. That's what she is. And she sees that her skill, she sees that she has a duty because she's a healer, she knows how to create medicines that cure the sick, that she needs to honor that. But it's not, again, it's not intended that then traps her in another trap, but rather she compels herself to her, reclaims herself, and then later on says, and once I've done that, I'm going to move on. And she does. So the responsibility to find spaces of accuracy within history, which is grey and complex, but to offer a narrative of optimism that actually not to repeat a downtrodden or destructive narrative about a woman or someone who identifies as a woman, felt a responsibility that Emily and I embraced very early on. We were both very interested in decolonization and interested in, through this process, exploring one another's ideas of feminism, which is a shifting landscape, as we all know.
Hmm. So actually, the skilled woman is the namesake of the goddess.
So Ishtar is a Yeah, she shares a namesake, absolutely. And it was very intentional because the piece is set within Carnival, and the name Ishtar is the root word for the name, for the word Easter. So it's the same, it's stories that are circling back on each other.
Yes, and I also think you have this very interesting twist. On the one hand, you were describing, you know, the Maria relationship with Henry, King of France, and the Maria relationship with this herb maker, Ishtar. So it's kind of, we can say that it's like, as you said, it's like a downdraining kind of destructive chain of oppression. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And each one oppress another. And yes. But also you shifted this kind of very depressive kind of tone into something optimistic. And you emphasize they're all seeking some, you know, healing cure for either for plague or, you know. And you have this very interesting thing going on. Maria wants this aphrodisiac, right?
Yeah, totally.
She's desperate one.
She desperately, because I think that she doesn't feel sexually attracted to the King of France. So like any good businesswoman or thinker or creator or person who has a task, she asks herself, okay, what do I have to do? And she's like, okay, so what I'll have to do is I need to take something to get me through this, because she knows that in her social setting, the duty that she has is to bear children. So from her perspective, she doesn't want to go through a brutal rape, which is what it would be. What she wants to do is to try and find some sexual joy, some kind, because she's experienced this with Venus. They have had a full relationship. And when we think of women of the status of Marie de Medici of that time, very sexually fluid, very gender fluid time. It's only post-colonialism that we have really found labels for gender, found labels and made divisions. I don't need to tell you that. You know more about that than I do. Of course you do. But in the context of our conversation, to give some detail. So she is someone that would have been very sexually fluent and would know her mind and would know her body. And she's spent her life being trained to be a leader. But she's desperate to try and find a way to get through this wedding night because she knows she has to come good. She's got business to do. Hence the letter to Shah Abbas, who asked for an aphrodisiac, because so many of the botanical medicines within Florence at that time came from Iran. They were specimens and a form of colonization or a form of preservation, depending on your position.
Yes, so, and also the figure of leader is very interesting. Mm. And you also identify with this, you know, through your self-introduction, because you call yourself a leadership consultant, right? And yeah. Also you explore what leader can do, or who is the leader, or who should be the leader, or who will be the leader in various contexts throughout your different works. So just give us some reflection or thoughts on leadership.
I think, and this is something I continue to learn about. For me, there needs to be a measure of empathy, a measure of creativity, a measure of compassion, an understanding of equity, and an awareness that any good leadership also needs to rest and to follow. To be a good leader, you need to know what it means to be a good follower and everything else in between. And that it is not a static, way of being.
And what draws you into exploring this theme so extensively in different kind of way?
In different way, I think for me, it comes back to what we were talking about, responsibility, a sense of duty, a sense of an interest in self-determination, I'm always drawn to collaboration because I can see that together we are greater. Even in this conversation, I could be sat talking to the wall. It would be interesting for a small amount of time. But what really ignites this for me is that you and I are in dialogue. And then there we go. Something magical starts to happen in the way that even in this conversation, one of us is accelerating, the other one is braking. One of us is leading, the other one is following. And we are forever changing those roles, even in our conversation right now. And that's really exciting to me. It's the caring and seeing of another human being to be able to identify and elevate them even further.
I think that's interesting because if it's an equitable way of equitable interaction you are striving for, and then leadership sometimes give people this idea of hierarchy, right? There's superior and inferior.
Yeah.
So you are interested in both, right?
I'm interested in both because I'm interested in hierarchical structure. I'm interested in horizontal. I'm interested in a more herd mentality. I think that multiple modes of leadership. I'm interested in triumvirates. I'm interested in group leadership. I'm interested in singular. I don't ever think it is one size fits all. And I also don't think that in any one given process, the model ought to stay the same. Because the context environment is always shifting and tilting. It is alive. So for me, there isn't a singular mode or model.
And you mentioned that in the piece, you are a collaborator with the composer, Emily, and you have this collaborative agreement at the beginning.
Yeah.
And now in your future PhD, you're exploring this kind of collaborative framework.
Yes.
So how does your collaborative agreement with her works out? Is it everything goes as you imagined, or there's some surprising things happened?
It's an excellent question. Yeah, our collaborative agreement worked because we worked hard and we worked smart and we worked with a shared vision and we worked to be human within it as well. We worked to be spacious with each other. We held each other to account in a manner which was respectful. It's fascinating because I have this, I have a huge amount of respect for her and I know that she shares that for me. So for us, it wasn't ever about what was, for our dynamic, we were fine. We were okay. Sure, there was moments where one of us felt a bit more stressed than the other and the other would say, it's okay. What do you need? What can I do? It's more that it's about addressing a system. Emily and I were working with a system that could be unexpected, could be at times contradictory. So rather, we were navigating. It wasn't about navigating each other. It was about navigating the making process.
So in this making process, who else or what else are involved?
So for our collaboration, there was myself as a librettist and Emily as the composer. And what I should point out straight away there is that it was a singular role, which was really quite a luxury for me to be able to just focus on being in one function. Then, of course, Emily and I had our respective academic supervisors. We had the head of our composition department was involved. There was a conductor, assistant conductor, a director, an assistant director. There was the three singers and then the broader chorus. So we were a company of 11 performers. There was a stage management team, a full team. There was a designer. There was a lighting designer. There were technicians. There was, of course, the people who looked after the venue, the space that we worked in, the school itself. So you can see that we became quite a great number of people. However, looking ahead, and you're alluding to my PhD, where I'm looking to create a collaboration. One of the three outputs is a collaboration framework. For me, it's about one-to-one accountability. It's about being able to find modes of needs and wants, being able to articulate those in order to have a framework which is scalable and one which can attend to principles and remains open for revision. I'm very interested. I've always been interested in how do we collaborate and how do we do it equitably so that it doesn't become about the system, but rather how do we work together? In what ways so that almost, and this is a terribly pompous and arrogant thing to say, but rather that what I hope with the framework is to offer one way of collaborating, which is equitable, that doesn't consciously have bias within it. There will be other biases, that all of us have biases, but that to offer something that works with contemporary opera as the catalyst for a collaborative framework.
And so what do you think about this idea of author? And so you are the people who write the script for this opera, right?
Yeah.
But can you claim the final piece you were the author of it? Or do you think there's a collective author?
I think this is a beautiful question because I am the librettist. I wrote the words. Emily is the composer. She wrote the music. But Emily and I, in our collaboration, our vision was to become indivisible. So by the time you see the whole score, you don't know who said what when. You can't tell what is Nazlee and what is Emily. But what you can tell is that it's Nazlee and Emily's work, or Emily and Nazlee's work. The authorship of that, I would suggest, is ours. The ownership of it is the whole creating company. The ultimate authorship and ownership is the audience, because they bring their perspective, they bring their lived experience. And without them, it is not a finished work. And what we hope as librettist and composer is that audiences in time will own the story and draw it in as something that belongs to them. It's a long ambition.
It is. Do you think the concept of authorship is still meaningful and useful then? Or do you think we should abandon the term at all?
I think it's a really, really fascinating time to be talking about authorship, because it conjures many things around power. It conjures ideas around copyright. It makes us think about, sometimes it can evoke an image of the individual suffering artist somewhere just doing some kind of genius act. And I don't doubt that there are those moments. This is a big world. A lot happens. But I believe that each of us are authors. I think the question is around ownership, more fully around ownership. But the dynamic between authorship and ownership is the space that culture can occupy. Being an author of a piece of work, yes, I would say that Emily and I are the authors of Paradise Garden, but the ultimate authoring of it happens in collaboration with our broader production team. The ownership of it cascades out from me and Emily, and I hope continues to audiences that will meet it in years to come. I think that you can be an author of a piece of work and be the person that sat next to you right now is an author of the work. I would suggest that you and I are authors of this conversation.
Yes, and listeners, according to your definition.
And the listeners are authoring through the detail and finding the ownership. I hope they can see something of themselves within this.
When you say ownership, you are saying not the property ownership, right? Not the economic ownership.
Not singularly.
It's more broad.
Yeah, a spiritual ownership or an emotional ownership or more broader than an economic. Thank you for the clarification. No, it's important.
Because, you know, this cultural stereotype was very much drawing on, you know, what are you talking about, ownership? Copyright?
Totally, totally. No, yeah. No, totally, totally. Yeah.
I'm aware of the time. So to cut it short, so one is you are going to start your PhD.
Yes.
And the one interesting thing is about what you call the methodology of cultural diplomacy. Can you just give us a taste of what
it's
going to be about?
My pleasure. My pleasure. And thank you for the invitation to touch on my PhD. So the output, there are three outputs. One, it will be a libretti, a cycle of libretti. The other will be looking at this collaborative framework, which we've spoken about. And the third output will be looking at cultural diplomacy. I'm very interested in how the discipline of art, of opera, is used as a mode of being able to strike international relationships. How do countries through opera make relationships? And for me, the focus that I will be applying for all of this will be the short-lived but tremendously internationally resonant Tehran Opera Company.
Yes. So thank you very much for coming to our conversation and sharing your wonderful thoughts with us, Natalie. And if we're me and, you know, as well as audience, if we're interested in your work, what's the best way to follow your future work?
Please find me on Twitter, and I'm sure there will be a link that will be shared. Thank you.
This was Artery with Isa Kavegia, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.